without microphone, but if you don't hear me, I can get wired. So I would like to thank the organizers for an opportunity to speak here. I must say, for me it was a little bit surprising to get invited to the conference in North Philly. So at first I started panicking what I would speak about. But then, fortunately, this work about denominators came about. So let me try to keep talking North Philly. So it's about denominators in Kemsevich integral or Kemsevich invariant, and it's a joint work with my graduate student Marsha Patrupayan and Pavel Sivera. So let me briefly recall some basic facts about this Kemsevich integral. So do not in R3, it associates an invariant of let's say I of k. And before we discuss in some gruesome details the construction of this invariant, let me say that it takes values in the so-called space of chord diagrams that probably most of you know much better than I. So these are rational combinations of the following pictures. You get an oriented circle, and then you choose pairs of points, and then you connect them by chords. And of course, it's all topological, so you can move points along the circle. But of course, you're not allowed to change the ordering of the points. So this is a typical chord diagram, and you should factor it by two relations. The first relation is like that. So if you have a single chord with no chord ends in between, then it should be put equal to zero. And then there is a second relation. Well, I see that my resource of blackboards is getting exhausted very, very quickly. Somewhat quicker than I expected. So the other one is a so-called 14 relation. And actually, you've seen this relation a half an hour ago in a David's talk. Let me draw it and write it. So the 4-tier relation is an alternate sum of 4 terms. So let me prepare the ground, and then we'll see whether I'll be able to write it correctly. Right, so let's say this will be the first one. So this will be with a different order. The second one, this will be the third one with a long chord, and then we again exchange the order and get one more term. Now, to make a contact with what David told you, so let's give labels to these strings, say 1, 2, and 3, and this chord will be called T12, and this chord will be called T23, and here we can see that this is a product of T12 times T23 in this order, in the order which corresponds to the endpoints. So then the first two terms, they become T12 commutated with T23. And if in addition you introduce a notation T13 for this long chord, so you get the relation that C12 plus T23, comma T23 is equal to zero. So that's a complicated, and that's the meaningful relation that we impose on those chord diagrams. And let me use the opportunity that I have this formula on the blackboard. And so there is the shorthand notation C123 for this combination, C1, 23 for this combination T12 plus T23. This is actually kind of trace of an operatic structure which exists in this theorem. But I don't think we'll get to it. So, an advantage of this story of numpapers is that I can state the result right away. So now I want to formulate this theorem about this invariant I of K. And, well, I want to explain, give you some more details on how the construction goes later on. So, as I said, the invariant takes values in rational combinations of Korn diagrams. So we may ask a question. Of course, we can ask many questions about it. We say want to compute it for various nodes, and we want to know all the details. But I can only tell you, give you some bound on denominators, which come about in this rational structure. So theorem gives you a bound on the denominators, and so I of k, it turns out to be an element in the sum from n 0 to infinity d of n minus 1, so this will be a denominator, times sum four diagrams with n ports, so here this is a number of ports. And now we only allow combinations of those elementary chord diagrams with integral coefficients. So now what is d of n? So d of n is a product of primes, and here it's a prime p to the power, let's call it bpn, and dp of n is a relatively simple linear function, so it's p over p minus 1 squared times n minus 1 over p minus 1. So that's basically the result that I want to present to you today. So I'll now perhaps make some remarks about this bound.
Do you normalize your I to be 1 on n?
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's normalized to be 1 on n. Oh, no. It's normalized to start with 1 in the extension.
It's always started with 1. But for unknown, it is just ended by 1.
No.
If you have to try it so for me.
No, I don't normalize it to be 1 on the unknown. I believe. Okay, let's see. Maybe you can tell me what's.
Since they didn't give definitions, so it's alright.
Yeah. So let me first give you some comments about this estimate. First of all, it's an improvement of an earlier result by Van Clair, and he had a different function which was roughly proportional to, but it's also not quite a linear function, right? There is this integer part, but so there was another estimate which was could write it. Now, there are the following features of this function. First of all, it's easy to observe that the p of p minus 1 is actually equal to 1. And in a certain sense, I'll comment on it a bit later, this result is optimal. So you cannot do much better. Otherwise, I don't know whether this result is optimal. Probably not. Probably, okay, who knows? We'll discuss it also in a moment. Then, BP of n is equal to 0 if n is bigger than, you see? Small, sorry. Yeah, if n is smaller than p minus 1. So in any event, this is important because you, in general, you only want a finite number of primes to show up here. And so if your prime is too big, then anyways, you get this exponent equal to 0 and it doesn't contribute. Perhaps one small observation is that, for instance, for n equal to 2, it's easy to compute this denominator g and or the estimate on denominator, and it will be given to 24, and we'll see this number 24 showing up in one of the normalizations in a moment. And finally, perhaps just to remind you that there is the following estimate on the chaotic valuation of n factorial, which means that we just count the power of p by which n factorial is divisible, and the standard estimate is the integer part of n minus 1 divided by p minus 1. So you see, normally one should not expect to be able to do much better than the n factorial estimate for the denominator, because this conservation invariant is some kind of group-like element. In group-like elements, normally in the expansion, you expect factorials to show up in the denominator. So you see, this guy grows a bit faster, a little bit, tiny bit faster than n factorial, but well, here I don't know. Maybe one can bring it to the growth n over p minus 1, or maybe not. That we don't know, unfortunately. So now let me tell you how those estimates, what's the origin of those estimates, how they come about. And here I should go back to the theory that David mentioned in his talk, which is the theory of Grimfield associated. In fact, to be honest, the whole technique and the whole story goes around associated. So I will have to tell you a little bit about it, hopefully not too much. David already gave a definition of associators. Let me give another one, which is more explicit. Associators. So an associator is an element, is a formal power series in two non-commutant variables. So I use this, so this is non-commutative formal power series. Here we choose K, the field of characteristic 0, and it has two properties. So the first property is that phi, oh, maybe we should we say group-like? Not necessarily, but it usually is required to be group-like. So phi starts with 1 plus 1 over 24 commutator of x and y, so xy minus yx. Actually, now we know why it is 24. After all, I mean, we're speaking about denominators. This is the future degree 2 contribution somewhere, so it better have a denominator which is divisible by, which is a divisor of 24. Otherwise, this theory would not be correct. So, the second condition is actually the main condition on the associated, so let me write it down here. So it's called the Paragon equation. So let me write it down and explain a little bit what it means. So first of all, the Pentagon equation, it's an algebraic equation which involves five phis. So one way to write it, like there are three phis with different indices on the left, and two phis with different indices on the right. Now, of course, I should explain what it actually means. For that, let me draw the following picture. So, get back to our Torr diagram row, and let's have four elements of the string with numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. And, of course, now we will have all possible chords.
No, what they don't understand, your phi is a function in two variables.
That's right. I'll now say how it fits. So I have all possible chords. For instance, this is T12, and this is T34. And by definition, I put phi 1, 2, 3 is phi, where I substitute instead of x and y, T12 and T23. And then, of course, I can play the same trick with all other phis, and it's okay if the index is doubled, because I know what to do, right? Then I should take T12 plus T23, plus T13, to get the corresponding T. So, let's substitute all those phis, where formally, instead of variables, you put in chords, and then, of course, the 4T relation is imposed. Right, so this is an equation modulo this 4T relation. So we put in all those chords, and it should be satisfied modulo 4T relation. So at first, it looks as a very, very complicated algebraic equation. So this first impression is correct. So we're gonna get back to the discussion of this equation in a little bit more detail in a moment.
Where's the Pentagon?
The Pentagon. So you see, okay. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so that's the first thing. But there are many, many, okay, I'll probably show some more geometric pictures in a moment. So the there are various ways to associate to the Pentagon, but let's say the first simplest idea is that there are five phis. So there are five corners of something. Okay. So let me now tell you a little bit about the construction of the conservation theorem. I guess many of you know it much better than I. But so there are different constructions. Originally, the conservation theorem was defined as an integral. That's why it's called the conservation integral. But there is another construction in terms of the associator, and so that's the one that we're gonna use. So, in fact, at first, it will depend on phi. So, we choose a solution of these equations. David already mentioned that solutions exist, so we're going back to this discussion in a moment. So, we choose a solution of the pentagonal equation, and we define, for naught, we define an object which is called I phi of k. Here I must say I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to give the essential parts of the construction, but I'm going to cut some corners. And basically the scheme is as follows. One starts with an odd diagram. Well, I think at this conference there is a very high standard on drawing those diagrams. I certainly cannot match this, right? I see people kind of basically it goes very fluently. Well, I'm not sure, maybe it's unknotted or something, but it seems not okay.
It is a dagger.
Very checking whether I know what crossing is. Right. Now, the second step is to split in elementary pieces. And here, the elementary pieces, I'm not sure. Okay, there are standard ones that you, of course, you're all using, right? There is an undercrossing and an overcrossing. For a moment, let me not put orientation. So there will be an orientation on the circle. So there are. I'll be thinking of this node diagram is drawn on a plane with a height function chosen. So it will be some kind of nice height function. So there will be pieces like that, so minimum and maximum, and there will be pieces like that. So I'll be thinking that some of the pieces of the diagram are close to each other, and some of them are far away, and so there will be moves like that, where you move one of these strings from the vicinity of the second one to the vicinity of the third one. So these are six elementary moves plus the choice of orientation. Now the next step is to decorate them with quartz. So here I'll give two examples how I've decorated the sports. So one example is say an overcrossing. So it's mapped to the exponential of 2/2 times this overcrossing, which actually means in practice that we take this picture plus we add this picture with a four, which is horizontal, plus this picture 1/2 pectoral with two chords and so on. So the C which stands in the exponent, this is a horizontal chord of this time. Now the essential part of it is that this picture gets replaced by this picture times an associator. Let's say if the indices of these strings were 1, 2, and 3. So this will be 5, 1, 2, 3. And in practice this means that, for instance, in this 5, perhaps there is a contribution T1, 2, T2, 3. Then this contribution would correspond to adding one chord here and one chord there. And so on. So this infinite series would produce for you an infinite series of diagrams with chords. The tricky point is what to do with these parts. It's actually related to the question, the dangerous question that you asked. So here one should also do something, but let me skip this tricky point. And finally, the last move. So this is move number 1, number 2, number 3, and move number 4. Read it. As a chord diagram. So which means that now we get our circle with chords, we forget about the embedding, we forget about the structure of the node diagram, we just look at it as a circle with chords, chords allocated where they are, and we treat it as a chord diagram. So that's the way of obtaining hydrogen. Now, let me state a theorem which belongs to Levi-Murakami. So originally, this invariant was defined by Kincevich in a different way, but in this form, let me summarize its properties as follows. So, first of all, I thought, okay, is not invariant, so it's independent of the choices of the NOT diagram and of the phi function, and also, so this, I think this was already discussed in at the end of David's talk. It's independent of phi, so you can choose whatever solution of the associated or the pentagonal equation, and you always get the same thing. Of course, well, I don't know, you can view it as both positive and negative. We're going to, of course, use it as a positive fact. Probably negative thing about it, that indeed it's not so clear why should we construct this invariant using phi. Maybe we should use some easier tools to proceed with this construction. But still, it's a very nice fact. And let me now mention what are the choices for phi that we have. So the pentagonal equation was studied by Grünfeld. So Grünfeld proved the existence of solutions. It was also important contributions of Dror Bar-Matan in the theory of this equation. So choices of phi. So the Grünfeld gave an explicit phi which is defined over complex numbers. And he proved an existence of rational solutions. So now you see, since rational phi exists, this immediately implies that I phi of k is rational. Since I phi does not depend on phi, so you just substitute this rational phi, and you get a rational expression for the invariant. The problem with this approach is that it's considered to be a difficult problem finding kind of more or less explicit or some kind of formula for a rational solution. So the existence of a rational solution is known, but there is no, at least as far as I know, no practical way to construct those rational solutions. So we don't kind of, it's an object which up to now escapes our studies, and so now actually what I want to present to you, this result that I shown here comes from a result about rational associators. So I want to give you some partial information about rational associators. Namely, we know how to give bounds on denominators of rational associators.
Dror's algorithm gives a rational, right?
Sorry?
Dror's algorithm gives a rational associator.
Drinfeld plagiarized by Dror.
Okay, but you made it an algorithm.
Maybe.
So now the theorem says that there is an associator over Q such that phi an element, sum from 0 to infinity, d of n minus 1 times. Now we take those polynomials with integer coefficients and we take a degree as 1. So there is a solution such that all denominators are divisors of d of n in degree n. Or in principle you can say if you consider each degree separately, then it's an integer solution up to this common denominator. But it might be, the denominator might be smaller, but it might be a divisor of d of n, but such a thing exists. And this immediately, actually this more or less immediately implies the theorem of I of k. In fact, in deconstruction, as you saw in deconstruction of I of k, there is this associator, there is the exponential function, and there is this normalization that I didn't make explicit. But basically, the main thing is to have some estimate for associators, and this guarantees that there would be an estimate for the Kincevich invariant. One remark concerning the optimality of those bounds. So I said that some of those bounds, at least one of those bounds, is optimal. So let me again cheat a little bit, but let's just show you something. So a remark. So recall that we have this bound PP of P minus 1 equal 1, and I said that it was optimal. So in what sense? In fact, here we see some relation between the theory of associators and some relatively elementary Lie theory. Let's do the following. Let's take the degree p minus 1 part of the associator. Right? It's a non-commutative polynomial. Let's multiply it by p. We know that if you think about p, the denominator contains p to the power 1. So now we killed this p in the denominator. And let's consider it mod p. So we now kind of can throw away anything which is divisible by p. So it turns out that the following is true. First of all, sigma p turns out to be an element of the free Lie algebra with two generators. Right? A priori, this was some kind of non-commutative polynomial, but we can actually rewrite it in terms of Lie brackets. So it's a multiple Lie bracket. And, I'm not sure. I'm not using those parts on the black, but is it the right decision? Okay. Yeah. No, I tried anything. I don't think it would help much. Really. And then there is the following formula. X bracket with sigma p minus x minus y x plus y sigma p minus x minus y y. This is equal to, let me call it jp of x y. I don't know, it depends on how detailed your course in Lie theory was, but this is something from elementary Lie theory. It's called a Jacobson element. And it's equal to x plus y to the power of p minus x to the p minus y to the p mod p. So one miracle is that if you consider this element mod p, it's actually an element of the Lie algebra. So it's also a combination of multiple Lie brackets. At first it doesn't look like that, but if you take seriously this mod p part, it turns out to be a multiple combination of Lie brackets. And So this part of the this residue of the associate, it kind of gives you this JP. Well, again, we know that this is non-zero, so this sigma p cannot possibly be zero. That's why this estimate here is sharp. It cannot be this dp of p minus 1 cannot be zero, because then sigma p is zero, right? If you took something which had no p in the denominator, multiplied by p, and took mod p, then it would have been zero. And then sigma p would have been zero, and then jp would have been zero, and then the elementary books on this theory would have been wrong, which would be certainly not a very good scenario. So now let's discuss a little bit this theorem. So you see, I planned my talk in such a way that now there is a little bit of time to discuss the proof. Frankly, I'm not sure whether it's a good idea, but let's try it out. So the ideas of the proof. Combination of three observations, and well, here perhaps I would allow myself to write something which, who knows, might even be interesting for experts. So there are three steps here. So one step is as follows: associators are related to a famous group called the Grothendieck-Kalkmüller group, which consists of pairs of elements. So here, usually there is a field in the definition. So lambda is an invariable element of this field, and f is again a power series, a formal power, non-commutative formal power series of the type of the associator. So there are some complicated equations of the pentagonal type verified by f. But let's not go into it. So the fact is as follows. Suppose that lambda is not a root of 1. So then it turns out there is a unique associator phi such that the following equation is satisfied. So you conjugate the element or the argument of f by phi, multiply by phi, and you get on the right hand side phi of lambda x lambda 1. So this is actually this equation is standard in the theory of associators. It defines an action of the Grothendieck-Kalkmüller group on the set of associators, which possibly screws up the normalization condition. However, well, I don't know, maybe it's standard also, but they're using it in the other direction. Under some mild conditions on the GT element, on this lambda, we actually reconstruct phi from this F. And it turns out to be an associator. So, like, it gives some kind of bijection, you can say, a map from the GT group to the set of associators, and that's one thing that one should be using there. Now, what about the second move? So the second move is kind of mysterious, and it uses a very strong theorem, again due to Drinkfeld. So the second step is let's now choose K. So you see, I was kind of keeping this separate notation for the field, not putting it equal to Q, because now we put it to be chaotic rational numbers. And in this case, the Russian dictatorial group of QP is known to contain a lattice called GTP, such that, you see, so elements of the Russian dictatorial group, they consist of two parts. One of them is just a number, and another one is something complicated. Let's look at the map which forgets the complicated part and only keeps an easy part. And then it turns out that this lattice, it maps to topiatic integers. So it's easier than mapping to topiatic rationals. So it maps to topiatic integers. And moreover, for invertible topiatic integers, it's surjective. So this is the main part of it. So then, after that, basically, well, if we don't go into technical details, one can choose lambda t, ft, such that the associator that you would get from this step number one, let's call it phi p, verifies our estimates, and verifies estimates, this means that it has denominators with a given degree of p, right? Because now, since we are talking chaotic, we have only one prime, which is interesting for us. So, in this way, we obtain for every prime an associator called phi p. And the last step in the proof is as follows. So we have now a collection of those associators. So we have, let's say, phi 2, phi 3, phi 5, and so on. So for all primes. And out of that, they're constructing and associate all the rationals, which satisfies all the estimates, more or less by the Chinese remainder theorem. Here one should probably say, right, the equations for phi are highly non-linear, right? Usually you can imagine using the Chinese remainder theorem for some kind of linear equations. So here the equations are highly non-linear, but it turns out that there is one more bijection, so we already used some kind of bijection, or at least a map from elements of GT to associators. But then there is also some other bijection which goes as follows. So you define phi lambda of xy equal to phi of lambda x lambda y, and one constructs an element psi which is d phi lambda over d lambda phi lambda minus 1. And this is an element of the Lie algebra, or whatever it's called, the Lie algebra of the Grothendieck-Müller group. So now you see, you can now turn all those associators for different primes into some elements in the vector space, in different vector spaces, and then from elements of vector spaces over different QPs, you can already hope to get an element in the corresponding vector space over Q. And that's actually what happens. Of course, one should still figure out that all the bounds are verified, but I guess by now you would be happy to believe that. Right, so that's basically the scheme of the proof. I should say that there is an interesting, of course, several interesting outstanding questions. Of course, the big question would be how to really make it practical, this construction of rational associators. But maybe a bit less ambitious question, we have an estimate on denominators. Perhaps it would be interesting to say something about numerators. I mean, for instance, make also an estimate on numerators, or maybe give some nice interpretation to numerators to say what they are. But here, at the moment, we have nothing to say.
So that would be it. Yes. Do you have any calculation for lower terms of that your particular associator.
Oh, but there is no particular.
But you have quite explicit 5.2, 5.3 for it.
No, because you see, yeah, there is.
Is that the existence theory here that you choose? Is it only existence?
No. But wait. You see, the first thing would be this thing, right?
Yes.
This would be this theorem. Yes, we don't, of course, we don't know.
No, so it is not constructive.
No. At least not.
So one of the way to have an optimal estimate, I mean some low estimate, is to plug in a Lie algebra weight system. For example, you take the theorem the unknown, even for SM2, which is quantum n, and then replace Q by e to the h. Then at least then the denominator you get there is the denominator of the.
You cannot get.
And then there you already see n plus 1 factorial.
So which means that yes, that one cannot get much better, right? Then, or you say even n plus 1, but
n plus 1.
But my function was growing a bit faster, right?
Yeah.
There instead of 1 over p minus 1 was p over p minus 1 squared.
Yeah.
So in principle, one can ask whether one can get a slope to be 1 over p minus 1.
Yeah. So the least, at least you must have n plus 1 factorial.
I think that for quantum invariants, actually, the growth is slower than
the. Just take the unknown. For
SL2, for unknown and SL2.
Yeah.
But it's not far, right? It's a small difference in the slope, but whether one can make a better argument, possibly. But it's not far from being optimal.
So, I vaguely remember when you did these estimates, it was used somehow for free manifold invariants, and I wonder whether these estimates are.
I think it was as far as I understood, right, from the discussion this time. I think that was the part of where it starts, right, where the prime enters, and then it's probably the same estimate as
for three manifold.
So this would not give a new information for three manifold, at least in this way, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of the estimate was already very good.
Okay.